From the heart of the Kootenays, this is the Friends of Kootenay Lake podcast series, Voices of the Lake.
A podcast that will expand your understanding and awareness of place as we dive into historical, current, and future narratives of the Kootenay Lake Basin.
I'm your solo host for the day, Kayla Tillipaw, broadcasting from the traditional territories of the Tunaha, the Sinaitchkst, the Tsuut'ina, and Seal First Nations. Today we're speaking with Neil Fletcher, the Manager of Conservation Stewardship with the British Columbia Wildlife Federation.
Neil obtained a Master's in Resource Management from Simon Fraser University and has since worked in government, industry, education, and finally the nonprofit sector. Neil is a wetlands expert with loads of experience aiding in the restoration of wetlands across the province, including wetlands around Kootenay Lake.
Neil also helped us to develop the Friends of Kootenay Lake Harrop Wetland Restoration Project. As you might have already guessed, this conversation focused on wetlands. Topics include importance of wetlands for lake ecosystem health, types of wetlands, wetlands' role in climate change, historical and current threats, where the province is at with wetland conservation and regulations, and how people can get involved in wetland conservation. This episode is a great listen for anyone looking to expand their knowledge on one of our most valuable and most threatened ecosystems.
I know Neil has a really good saying, I don't know if it's his, but I remember he said that wetlands are like nature's grocery store. They offer so much to all different species. It's incredible, you know.
I love that. That's so cute.
Isn't that so great? I just think it's so perfect because they are exactly that.
Neil gives some really good advice on how, even if you're not an ecologist or a biologist, or even if you don't work in the environmental sector at all, he gives really great advice about how you can get involved in wetland conservation.
Yeah, exactly. Artists, musicians, you know, anybody can work to amplify conservation ethics for their local environment. If you're passionate about it and you have a talent, like follow that talent. Stewardship societies and community organizations are really important for like helping interested individuals and guiding them to, you know, pursue something that they're passionate about, like a project they're passionate about, and then connecting them to people who can help them make that a reality or just to learn more. And I think that BC Wildlife Federation does that so well with their amazing courses that, you know, attracts people from all different sectors and interests. That's a great conversation. So we definitely just scratched the surface.
The song in this episode is called Fresh September Commute by the ever-talented Handsome Hansel. The song was inspired by a cool early morning drive, and I've got to admit that I downloaded this song and have listened to it now on many cool mornings. We love your stuff, Hansel. Check out Handsome Hansel on Spotify and on his Facebook page, where he posts just the greatest photos. Well, I want to thank you so much for being here today and for taking the time to have a conversation with me.
Thank you, Kayla.
So let's start off with a little easy icebreaker question. What was your last experience or adventure on or around Kootenay Lake?
Ooh, that's a good one. Most recent would have been last year, probably. So I live in New Westminster and generally make a trek out once or twice a year out to the Kootenay region. Last year, we held a Wetlands Institute in Creston, so that would have been the closest I was to Kootenay Lake at the time. We had people from all around the province with us, and we were learning about wetlands for 7 days. It's somewhat of an extension program and a therapy session for a lot of wetland practitioners to be coming out. So we visited a number of sites around the Creston area. They included Erickson Elementary School, this little headwater wetland near Lister Creek, and then also some of the lands that the Yakanuki First Nation own as well. Oh, well, and then the Crescent Valley Wildlife Management Area. So we're in and around that area as well as Rosslyn, but that's probably our closest to the Kootenay Lakes we were at last year. Yeah, and this year with COVID, obviously, we had to change things around a bit. I did have some crew members go out to the Kootenays this year, but
cool. That sounds like such an adventure.
Yeah, no, it was good. It was very good.
Awesome. So would you please tell me a little bit about yourself and the work that you do?
Yeah, my name's Neil Fletcher. I'm with the BC Wildlife Federation. I've been working with the Wildlife Federation for 10 years now. I started as a co-op student and transitioned into a wetland program coordinator, and now I look over three programs. So the wetlands program, youth program, and then this fishing program, which is just started this year.
Awesome, thank you. Why are wetlands important for lake ecosystem health?
Yeah, when a lot of lake stewards start looking at their program, they're doing measurements right in the lake in terms of dissolved oxygen and nutrient levels. And I think a lot of lake stewardship programs start because there's either concerns around too much vegetation starting to fill in around their lakes, or algae blooms that happen, or fish kills, or lack of fish. Shortly after they start noticing impacts, they start looking at what's the quality of the surrounding areas around their lake. And so wetlands are at the interface of the terrestrial and aquatic systems, and often are these habitats that can provide this opportunity to filter water that's coming through. They can provide habitat for fish. They can play a role in cycling carbon and also nutrients in the lake systems themselves. So they're intrinsically linked to the lake ecology and the health of them. And they're sort of at the front lines of receiving, as far as being receiving bodies to upstream developments and impacts that might be happening. A lot of lakes actually have wetlands around the perimeter that are in the lake themselves, and that would be sort of the deepest type of wetland you can have. And they become just as important, and I guess part of what we try to do is build appreciation for those types of aquatic systems.
Thank you so much. You mentioned that the wetlands and the vegetation that grows like within the perimeter of the lake is one of the deepest types of wetlands. What are some other wetland types and specifically ones that we can find in the region?
Sure. So the one I just described is called shallow open water wetland. So they have either floating aquatics, so that are right at the surface, or submergent aquatics, so aquatic plants that grow in them. And then as you go higher onto the landscape, you'll start to transition into some other ones. So as you go up, the next wetland you might see is a type of marsh, which would have emergent vegetation coming up. So it'll have these plants that are non-woody because trees still can't grow, but the plants will start shooting out of the water. So if you think of cattails or different types of grasses or sedges, so those would be what you'd transition into next. And then after that, if you're getting into slightly higher ground, you might get into these swamp type habitats. Swamps are where you have woody plants growing. So the trees are able to get a bit of oxygen into their roots. And they might just be on these raised mounds or something where they're able to grow. And then I'm not entirely sure about fens and bogs, but those are our peatland ecosystems. I'm not too familiar of seeing too many around Kootenay Lake. There is a possibility that fens used to exist more, like some of the peatland ecosystems used to exist more around Kootenay Lake, but a lot of the agricultural practices probably have drained a lot of those and have affected their hydrology.
Do you have a particular favorite kind of wetland that you like working within?
Yeah, the latter ones, the fens and the bogs, they're really, so these ones, what makes them different than the other ones I described is they have this deep layer of peat or organic material. And in some cases they can be many meters thick. And walking out into those, I always tell people it's like nature's mattress. It's like this beautiful place to stand. And if you're willing to get a little wet, if you lay down in those, it's sort of like this beautiful thing. They're just full of carbon right below the surface, but it's just this nice squishy sponge. And it's almost like you're being embraced by the wetland.
Beautiful.
Yeah, no, they're lovely places. But I like all types of wetlands. I can't really pick a favorite. And they're all unique too. Like, so each one, despite the fact we have this classification system that puts them into boxes, which wetlands don't normally like to be in, we put these into boxes, but they all have their unique character. So when you go to a wetland, how the water is flowing through it, the parameters around the types of wildlife that are using them are all very unique to that location. So that every time we take people out to the field, it's like you're exploring a new system.
Cool. Thank you so much, Neil. Many people look to wetlands as a way to mitigate the effects of climate change. Do you think that this claim is overstated or accurate, and why?
You know, it's interesting, and I'm glad you bring that up, because I think there's some misconceptions about wetlands, and they kind of all get put into the same box in terms of what they can do in terms of climate change. And this is the same for other services that wetlands might provide. So I think sometimes people get overzealous and they'll just say like, oh, it's a wetland, it's got to be good for climate change. But there's different aspects to that. So I would start with, are we talking about mitigation or adaptation? So in the terms of mitigation, we're talking about wetlands that might be able to capture and sequester carbon. So they're actually trying to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, for instance. It turns out that a lot of our wetlands, they can be very productive and capture a lot of carbon throughout the year, but they also release methane gas. And so our freshwater systems typically aren't the greatest at capturing carbon on an annual basis. Now the peatlands, they store a lot of carbon. So in terms of carbon storage, we don't want to be losing our peatlands because they're holding a lot of carbon below ground. When it comes to adaptation, there are some wetlands that can play a role there. So that's where you would have, this is when you're dealing with the effects of climate change. So flood control is a good example. And I'd look to places like Grand Forks, where they're actually pulling back some of their floodplain right now to allow the river to run into this floodplain system where homes used to be. And that's still an ongoing process, but it's an example of where there used to be more floodplain habitat to allow the river to expand at certain times. Not all wetlands play the same role with all these services. So you really have to look at the context that wetland is to determine if it's going to be a benefit to adaptation.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You mentioned that the peatlands are really beneficial in storing carbon. And then earlier you mentioned that there's maybe not as many peatlands, so the bogs and the fens, correct, as there used to be. Is there a reason why there's not as many of them now?
Yeah, well, I'll start with at a global perspective. So if you look globally, we're losing wetlands at about 3 times the rate as we're losing forests. And then when you look at the last, I believe it's, if I get the quote right, it's in the last 45 years, we've lost 35% of our wetlands globally.
Wow.
Not in what wetlands were lost prior to that. Now, when we take the context of Canada or BC, in developed areas, so that's where we live and where a lot of places have been settled, wetland loss since pre-contact may be upwards of 95%. Now, the reason being is a lot of us live in valleys. A lot of us like to live in these low-lying, flat, sloped areas adjacent to these bodies of water. And those are also where wetlands tend to be as well on the landscape. So the reason we're losing more wetlands than we're losing forests is because we're occupying those spaces. We've converted a lot of wetlands to agricultural land. And then after that, there's pressures of like other types of development that go on to that. But if you look at it almost anywhere in BC, we're congregating in these flat valley bottoms. And those are hotspots for species at risk. They're hotspots for wildlife corridors. They're really important. I think the thing is there's a trade-off. There's a trade-off of where we live and the impacts that it has to our wildlife and species at risk and our wetlands.
Wow, those are some pretty sad statistics that you just threw at me. Yeah, crazy. That's a huge loss. And, you know, I've always been really curious about what these ecosystems used to look like before they were developed. Because I've noticed those patterns about settling in the flat valley bottoms next to water bodies. And I've always wondered, what did these ecosystems look like before? You almost never see valley bottoms that are uninhabited by humans. So like it's almost like a lost ecosystem, like one that we'll never get to see. And I've always been very curious about that. What are some other threats to wetlands, especially current threats? And what are the most imminent ones and ones that we should be most concerned about?
That's a very good question. I mean, I think development's still happening. But probably in BC, a lot of agricultural land has been taken up so far. And it's done a lot of work at draining wetlands throughout the province. So just as far as like when you mentioned, you wonder what the valleys look like. If you ever see a straightened channel in a flat valley, it's often a ditch. And it's often a ditch because it's conveying water where people don't want it anymore. and there's lots of ditches around. When it comes to other threats, it's sort of like, I think a lot of it has to do with this issue we have called death by a thousand cuts, where we have all these little decisions that are being made on the landscape. A lot of private land is owned in these valley ecosystems, and each private landowner has a decision to make on how much they develop their land. And there's regulations in place that do potentially protect wetlands, but then there's the reality of how people are developing their land. And so I think piecemeal by piecemeal, we're losing them largely on private lands, or it could be development. So it could be more urban planned type of development, multi-home units going in. But I think piecemeal, each landowner who has a wetland, they should be very proud of it and embracing that as part of where they live and enjoying it more. But typically it's not necessarily seen that way. So I think that's one of the threats. And then one of the ongoing threats would be invasive species as well. So the remaining wetlands that we have, they're not necessarily pristine, especially in developed areas. So where we have a lot of settlements, people have probably been through there before. It could be that there was forestry it cleared in 30, 40 years ago. There might be trace evidence of people being on the landscape, but they might have drained those wetlands, and sometimes that's hard to pick up. So invasive species, climate change is becoming a common consideration of what might be a threat. So some of our smaller wetlands that rely just on surface water, for instance, could be at threat due to climate change. I guess I'll leave it at that. I think there's sort of this, both the idea of loss and then the idea of degradation of the remaining wetlands. And so better land management practices would be needed to sort of curb some of those impacts.
Thanks, Neil. I think you brought up a really good call out or message in what you were saying about landowners with wetlands on their property. I think it'd be very interesting to try and find a way to like spread that message and spread that awareness to landowners so that they can embrace the beautiful ecosystem that they're inhabiting.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some people around Kootenai Lake that get it and that really value the wetlands on their landscape. We've been fortunate to work with a number of them up in the Meadow Creek region. And if you're driving in a Meadow Creek, you'll probably see a couple of wetland signs along the way. And it's interesting because we started with one property owner and the neighbors became interested, and two neighbors on adjacent properties also asked for wetlands on their property to be restored after seeing the work of the first. And it's sort of this value that's underrepresented just in general. And it's not necessarily listed on your real estate listing when you're looking at all the features of your property you're buying. A lot of people still probably consider it an encumbrance to development and to what they wanted their dream property to look like. I would hope that some of the work that we're doing, and also Friends of Kootenai Lake are trying to build that awareness and that appreciation of these ecosystems as being these really valuable assets. And hey, you just, you know, you're now a land steward if you want it to be or not, you know, now that you have this, what are you going to do with that great responsibility? So I think changing minds and getting excited about what's living in them can be really important to changing perceptions around those types of habitats.
I love to hear that. And in your experience doing the work and getting in there and getting dirty and then showing results is what really gets people interested. Mm-hmm. It makes me wonder, you might be aware of our work at the Sunshine Bay or Harrop Wetland. And then you mentioned Meadow Creek. Are there any other wetlands around Kootenai Lake or any other efforts happening around Kootenai Lake to monitor or restore wetlands?
Yeah, well, when I think about it, I'm aware of, like, I'm definitely aware of the Harrop Proctor project. I met with a former staff member of Friends of Kootenai Lake, but she took us out there to look at the site pre-restoration, and yeah, it was wonderful. We met the property owners who really cared about those wetlands and I think are still probably quite active in at that site. I think it's on regional district property, if I'm not mistaken, but the neighboring landowners are quite interested. But as far as your question goes, so there's work in Meadow Creek. There's a couple Nature Trust and Nature Conservancy properties up that way as well. And it's more intact as far as the valley than other areas of the Kootenays that I've seen. But small projects in, say, Nelson. I know there's a couple of small projects around there, around Duck Bay. And then if you go further south, there's the Crescent Valley Wildlife Management Area, and there's lots of activity going on around there, as well as the Yakanuki wetlands a little further south. Oh, and then Crawford Bay, a new regional park was just designated. I did a quick analysis on it a couple of years ago, and it looked like it was the second largest wetland complex that they just acquired within that area of all of Kootenai Lake. And so it's a really important feature that the regional district purchased, and excited to see where they take it. That previous to being a park, it had some development on it. So I think there had been some drainage activity. So it'll be interesting to see how the regional district restores it over time.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. Wow. It sounds like there's a lot of areas, and I'm kind of like in a good distribution all around the lake. And it seems like there's a lot of wetlands that are on people's properties. So it kind of segues into my next question. What would be your advice to an organization or an individual looking to build or restore a wetland area, whether it be on their private property or on public lands?
Yeah. I mean, theoretically you can build a wetland anywhere, but there's some properties that lend themselves better to doing that type of work. If it's a smaller project, the landowner probably can proceed and do the work on their own. It is helpful to take workshops or learn about what you're doing before you start messing around with shovels and things. And there's also permits, not to mention, that are required for some of that work.
Yeah, of course.
But our organization offers training on it. We do, like, the 7-day workshop I mentioned is really, like, you apply to come to it and often come with a project in mind. And we have had private landowners attend that. But there's other resources as well that are available to learn more about the types of wetlands that are out there. So I'd first say make sure you're working with, you know, consulting with an expert or reading literature on it. We have a restoration specialist from Kentucky who actually comes up every year, Tom Bibighauser, and he's written a couple of books on wetland restoration. And so though there's all sorts of resources. I'd say reach out to a local organization that has experience That's one option. And then the first part would be to look at your site and see what kind of characteristics are there. As far as getting involved from an organizational perspective, sometimes what happens is you might have multiple landowners that approach you, and you might have to prioritize which one you might be wanting to do. And so some of the factors that we're looking at as far as the benefits to wildlife would be how connected would this wetland be to other natural habitat in their area. Is it a restoration project or is it a creation project? So if it's a restoration, we're looking at a site that's been degraded and we're trying to bring it back to its former glory, so to speak. The cost per hectare of doing the work or the cost per square meter comes into play as in terms of deciding which project you're going to do. Yeah, I mean, there can be benefits, and depending on what all those benefits are, we've done really small projects with schoolyards, for instance, and the objective is not necessarily to have a lot of wildlife using it, but more to provide an opportunity for kids to get out and learn about those sites. So it's basically a schoolyard wetland. That's a very different objective than maybe one for wildlife in particular. Some of the ones we've said no to, as from an organizational perspective, is when people want to build a pond, say in their backyard, and they live in an urban environment. It's hard to, I mean, I encourage landowners to build those types of wetlands, but from a conservation perspective, it's better to have sites that are more connected to the land base.
Thank you. As a side question, you kind of made me curious about something when you were talking about like assessing the cost of enhancing or building a wetland. In your experience, do landowners ever have to contribute any of the cost of restoring a wetland on their property? Or is it normally covered by grants through the organization that's helping?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to be going to, like, in the past, we've flip the bill through grants for a lot of the projects we've done. Although to some degree, the landowner is giving up a portion of their land to the project, you know, so they're donating something that could have been converted potentially into a field, like an agricultural field or something, like, you know, maybe they'd have outbuildings put on there, who knows. So there is a cost to the landowner in terms of that. But I think as more and more landowners are interested in doing this, that will be factored in. Is there something they can contribute to it? And because you can't do it all, and there's limited resources in terms of how much funding is available to do that kind of work. I think it's great that there are some grant organizations that will consider funding wetlands on private land, and it's just a matter of finding the right properties that fit the objectives of that organization. But it is very limited, and that's why I think we're a bit selective now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. What role can people play in conserving wetlands?
That's such a good question. I often think of that everybody has a strength. Like, everybody has their own skill set that they're coming to the table with, and you're doing podcasts, right? So you're educating people and building awareness through podcasts. Some other people might be artists. Some people might be really good. They might speak very well. They might have great communication skills. There could be people that are politically savvy. So I think it one is to know what your talent is and what kind of drives you in terms of if you're wanting to get involved in conservation, like, build upon the skill sets that you have already and what also drives you. And then there's a way to get involved in conservation. There's so many different avenues. And I think each person has like their unique path that they might need to take to get there. And then obviously, like, if you don't know anything about wetlands, then, you know, build that into the trajectory of what you're going to be doing. Take some courses, look for some online tools, and but I think everybody has a role to play, we're all stewards of the land if we're interacting with it, if we're eating from it. You know, we all are eating from it, right? So even if you don't own land, there's ways of getting involved. And I think we all have assets in our that we can put towards conservation.
Thank you for that message. I wholeheartedly agree. You know, we all take from this land and we all depend on it. And I think that we all have a responsibility to give back in whatever way we can, whatever capacity and with our individual skills. Thank you. That's such a beautiful message to send. So here's a bit of a nitty gritty question. Mm-hmm. Where is British Columbia in terms of wetland conservation? How well is our province doing? And do we have sufficient regulations?
So back in 2016, for the first time, wetlands were described very, like, much better than they were before in terms of the Water Sustainability Act. So within the Water Sustainability Act, if you're a lawyer, you're concerned about this definition of streams. And streams in legal speak includes wetlands. So like within the Water Sustainability Act, it's become very clear that if you're working in and around water, or if you're working in and around wetlands, if you're a private landowner, if it's on Crown land, those sites require a permit. They require some form of approval to do works in and around wetlands. So kudos to the province for putting that into the Water Sustainability Act. Prior to that, it was pretty dismal. There's still a lot that the province can do, though. So I think that that this has developed sort of a check and balance in terms of if there's work that you see going on somebody's property, you can call a natural resource officer. You can call the report all poachers and the rap line, basically, and they will they will hopefully investigate what's going on if somebody is going in and around water. So that way they're protected. There's a signal there, at least a trigger for people to get conservation officers to get involved or natural resource officers to get involved. But in the context of the rest of Canada and the states, there's still a lot that BC is falling behind on. I don't ever want to discourage the province from doing better, though, and want to, you know, celebrate the wins. There's other regulations as well, but so where could we do better? Right now, it's really up to the reviewer of a permit application on how wetlands are treated. So, you know, you need a permit, but if you get a permit, you could potentially damage a wetland. So what is the end result? Do we know which wetlands we should be protecting and not impacting at all? Like, are there ones that are so valuable that we don't want to lose, a single square meter of it? Or are there other wetlands that, you know, maybe they don't provide a lot of services and maybe we're being a little too protective around some of those ones. So we don't have any tools really when it comes to knowing which ones are valuable and which ones aren't. It's really up to the discretion of the decision makers right now. And it's not clear or transparent on how those decisions are being made. So I think, and when we look at other provinces and jurisdictions, they do have tools that help them look at wetlands objectively and make better decisions that are transparent and clear on how they might be mitigating any impacts to those wetlands. So I think we still have a ways to go in terms of our regulations and then more clarity both for citizens as well as developers and people who might have to be dealing with these regulators as well. So other provinces and jurisdictions do have more clear, transparent processes in place. I think maybe because it's a new act, we're just not there. And I don't see a lot of political pressure currently that's saying that they're going to be changing anytime soon. I'd encourage people that work for the province to think about it and think about how they could advance the dial. there was a study recently done. It might have been before the act was put into place, but at that time, the province had a failing grade in terms of its regulations. So there's ways to go, but we have made some wins.
Oh, that's so interesting. I didn't realize that we didn't have a concrete tool or guidelines to assessing wetlands and determining where our conservation priorities should go. I think that speaks to the importance of continuing this work and developing these tools and creating a really solid framework so that we can continue to conserve these really important ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I'll just mention is, there's the policy on paper, and then there's the implementation of it. And the every regional office seems to be under-resourced in terms of their ability to get out onto the land and investigate, and also to even just approve the permits. So it's an it seems, at least just from our perspective, as well as others that we've spoken to, that the water sustainability branch and like the work that they're doing is largely under-resourced and should, you know, funding our provincial dollars are going elsewhere, essentially. They're understaffed. Great people to work with, but just, I think, understaffed.
Yeah, I mean, I would ask you, like, do you think that more monetary value should be allocated toward projects like this and toward wetland stewardship and just overall environmental stewardship? But I'm sure that's a very political question.
I'm not against speaking to that. Like, so I don't work for the province. We have like BC in our name, but we're a nonprofit. So we can be a little bit adversarial and share our opinions, which is actually really lovely to be able to say what's on your mind and not be bound to, you know, the marching orders. I guess we have to be fairly careful though. We do receive funding from the province and appreciate it and all that. But I think there's one thing that has always struck me is just the approach. And it really depends. Like, we have some really strong staff that work for the province that have partnered with us on projects, and they've made the project that much better with their expertise, you know, what they can bring to the table. Often they're biologists or hydrologists that really care about what they do. And they have a passion for public service. But what they're doing currently seems to be beyond the scope of their work. Like, what they're doing is even beyond what they're supposed to be doing at work. So those are like the champions and the gatekeepers that we really want to keep within the province to help mobilize and lubricate like the restoration economy and like wetland protection and conservation. What I'd love to see is the province recognize how their role can be to be that lubricant and like that sort of like engine oil to like make the machine work. They might not be able to take on everything. Like, the province under the, you know, our current laws say that they're responsible for protecting and conserving water. Like, they're responsible for that part of the land base as the to benefit all of society. And it's under-resourced. What I'd love to see is to have designated point people in the province that work with local nonprofits, work with landowners, and their job is to be that engine oil that like basically provides opportunity and you know, helps guide and prioritize regional work for wetlands or, you know, other types of ecosystem values. I think they have an important role, and I think it's underutilized at a provincial level. And there's examples of other provincial organizations and programs doing this, like Fisheries and Oceans, at least on the coast. They have people that are engineers that work for the federal government. Those engineers will design projects and pass them to nonprofits and say, we need you to help us do this work. And it's a great partnership. It's bringing everybody together in a way that is building on their talents. And because the DFO can't do it all, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans can't do it all, they're working with their local partners to make everything work. And I just look at that model and go, why isn't this in the provincial government's hands, you know, for different regions? If I were to be investing my next dollar or the next person to hire in the province. That's where I'd put it. Are these sort of community advisors and supporters?
We had the exact same experience with our shore spawning kokanee habitat restoration project. You know, we really couldn't have done that project without the support of biologists from the province. It definitely speaks to our organization very strongly.
Yeah, and I don't know if the provincial staff would be able to speak that, you know, that freely about it, but there are champions and we've worked with them and we know they exist, but I just don't know if it's really in their job description. And it would, you know, every time we go to a new place, like another part of the province, I'm always like, okay, well, who's the champion here? Who's the gatekeeper who's going to help us? Because it really, they, yeah, there's a lot you can leverage with that. In addition to other like forms of government, you know, local First Nation governments, they also have, they can play an important role as well because they're managing the land base, right? And they have collectively have a vision for what they're wanting to do with it.
Absolutely. So our last question, are there any local opportunities for aspiring wetland stewards in British Columbia? And how can people find out more about upcoming events and workshops?
Yeah, so I think groups like your own have, I'm sure, some opportunities, some events, and you know, I know we partnered with you in the past to have planting events at some of our restoration sites, and that worked out really well. As far as our program, so our wetlands program has various levels of training from entry level to professionals in terms of the education that we provide. Thankfully, due to grants, we often are able to offer those workshops free of charge to participants. And on our website, if you go to the wetlands program section, there's a list of opportunities there. This year, due to COVID, we've moved a lot of things online. So we've been doing 3D tours of wetlands and trying to squeeze as much out of the virtual world as we can to make people feel like they're immersed in wetlands, basically. So yeah, 3D tours, quizzes, and you know, the competitive quizzes for people after they see a presentation, guest speakers who have lots of knowledge to share. And so I'd send people to our website probably for the most current information, but we are planning two virtual workshops in the Kootenai region coming up. We don't have dates for them yet, but they will happen before the end of March 31st. And one of them will be around sort of more in the Cranbrook area, or based on the Cranbrook area, looking at a study that was done on some wetlands that were on rangeland and are sort of might be impacted by cattle in some cases, and sort of how did that study prioritize sites to restore, as well as we're hoping to have somebody talk about fence maintenance, and so we're combining sort of how do you prioritize and then how do you make these fences that have longevity to protect the wetlands that might be most valuable. And then the other one was supposed to happen this year in Crawford Bay, but we've moved it back. We'll host something in Lou this year, but we're hoping to get out to Crawford Bay and build some excitement around the new regional district and look at some opportunities for restoration. So that might be a little nugget that we will carry on with, and we'll partner with local groups as well as the regional district and some of the nonprofits in the region to explore that further.
Sweet. So it sounds like there's some really good opportunities, local opportunities for people to get involved and learn more and participate in some really good work happening around the lake with wetlands.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm really happy like with where we've taken our COVID response, like our 3D remote tours. But once COVID is over, we're going to get back into the field. We're going to take people back in because there's nothing that replaces that experience. And they're fun to explore. They're really great places.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today and to have this conversation. Your input has been so valuable, and even personally, I've learned a lot. I'm so excited for this information to be shared.
That's awesome, Kayla. Well, thanks so much for having me join today, and I will want to catch up later and find out where Friends of Kootenai Lake is currently at and what projects you guys have in the hopper.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you so much, Neil. This has been really great.
Thanks for the opportunity.
See you.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to Voices of the Lake. As always, you can follow Friends of Kootenai Lake on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for ongoing updates on our projects and programs.
Huge thanks to our funders, the Osprey Community Foundation, the Regional District Central Kootenai, and the Nelson District Credit Union for helping us bring these stories to you.
Again, you're listening to Fresh September Commute by Handsome Hansel. Check out Handsome Hansel on Spotify and on Facebook.